From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we learn about the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project and some of Wisconsin's more scandalous history. Then the author of a coronavirus children's book explains how she hopes it'll help families cope through difficult times.
I was hoping to create a realistic situation about what a family may be dealing with, but yet really trying to have fun with it as well.
Plus, we learn about the career and legacy of South Milwaukee native and pro wrestler, Da Crusher.
He would come out to polka music. He would call himself the man that made Milwaukee famous. You know, back in Milwaukee, he won the crown of Mr. Saloon 10 years in a row, and that's because he could eat the most polar sausage and drink the most beer.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we're going to look at some of Wisconsin's more scandalous historical moments. We'll tell you about a children's book meant to help families cope with the pandemic and learn about South Milwaukee native and pro wrestler, Da Crusher. But we'll start with this. During the Great Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal sought to ease the pain of many Americans and put them back to work. His Works Project administration employed millions of Americans who rebuilt essential infrastructure like parks, roads, and housing. But the vast majority of these jobs went to unskilled men. Most opportunities for women required an education. Here in Milwaukee, a local program worked to change that. The Milwaukee Handicrafts Project hired unskilled women to mend textbooks, build furniture, and sew dolls, among many other things. Matthew Prigge wrote about the program for Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins me now to talk about it.
Obviously, the work situation all over was very hard. And specifically in relief efforts, the New Deal brought in by FDR, if you were a woman trying to find, if you'd lost your job or if someone in the household had lost their job and you needed to find work in this program that was designed to put people back to work, you had a pretty narrow path to finding something. They were, for the most part, only taking women who worked in what they would call the skilled trades, nursing, teaching, things like that. Those are the two big categories. And if you were somebody who had previously done labor work, worked with your hands, or if you're somebody who was trying to get into the workplace for the first time, you really didn't have a lot of options as it was initially set up.
Yeah, it seemed like there were options for men who mostly did this kind of labor. But when it came to women, as you say, there were few options. Until, of course, here in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project. What was the impetus for that?
Well, as I was saying, with these New Deal jobs, they were limited to one per household. And men always had the preference in getting these. So if there were households led by women, specifically unskilled women, for the most part, they had to stay on the local, called them the relief rolls, what we think of as welfare today. And basically, the original idea for this was just to kind of help Milwaukee County out in removing some of these people from their relief roles. So the local WPA administrators put a woman named Harriet Clinton, who had been kind of a groundbreaker in her own right. She graduated from journalism school from Columbia University. She'd worked as a reporter in Milwaukee when that was still a pretty rare thing for a woman to work in the newspaper business. They put her in charge of creating a program that could qualify for WPA funds, but target these, and again, what they would have called the unskilled women, just to basically shift the burden of having to pay relief to these women from the local government to the federal government.
When we say unskilled, I think some people might think of what we consider maybe less skilled labor today, but a lot of these women didn't speak English necessarily, and beyond that, even those who did speak English were often illiterate.
Right. Yeah, when I'm using unskilled, I'm using it in the terminology of the time, which, again, for women basically meant that you didn't have training as a nurse or a teacher or one of those profession like that. But when they got this project working, they realized that a lot of these, the women who had come there for work, were actually women who had, as you said, never worked before outside the household. A lot of these women came from conditions that were very impoverished, so even using more familiar tools like scissors, they weren't very familiar with. A lot of them were undernourished. In fact, one of the first hires, one of the first staff hires in this project was to bring a nurse on board, because a lot of these women were in poor health or even hadn't been eating enough. So it was, really a sect of Milwaukee that, if not for this project, probably would have never been brought on board for any kind of WPA work like this.
Yeah. The project itself was a little unclear at first. They had ideas for what these women would be doing, but it seemed like, to some extent, to put it, in today's terms, like busy work. But eventually, it does evolve into a lot of diverse kind of crafts that really contributed a lot. So what were the different things these women made through this project?
Right. It started out, just to get back to the point you mentioned about this, busy work or make work. The original idea it was similar to a lot of the New Deal projects through the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, was just to give people something to do. The adage that you pay one person to dig a hole and you pay another one to fill it back in. The original idea was pretty basic, just to make scrapbooks for county institutions, hospitals, orphanages, things like that, just to give people something colorful to look at. And Harriet Clinton, who was in charge of this, she reached out to a colleague of hers named Elsa Ulbricht, who was an art teacher in Milwaukee, and she dismissed this idea. She wanted this to be actually, what we call useful work, building things that were more advanced than, just pasting photos in an album. And she was the one who really drove the more artistic end of this. As you mentioned, they ended up doing very wide variety of different projects. They ended up having 11 different units that were, each unit was tasked with doing a different craft. There was a bookbinding unit, there was a doll making unit, a toy making unit, a furniture making unit. Eventually, they really branched out from this original idea of just giving these women something to do, and each of these units had a local artisan or teacher put in charge of it, who would design the projects, who would basically teach these women how to make this stuff. And they ended up building some really beautiful materials that lasted. Some of them are still in use today.
They made a lot of these things as well out of, it seemed like, found objects.
Yeah, this was a very resourceful project. The federal government basically took care of everyone's paychecks, and that was it. They needed to be self-sustaining on everything, materials and everything like that. So they were allowed to sell some of this stuff, but they could only sell it to tax-supported institutions, and they could only sell it at the cost of their products. So to get started, they had to use a lot of found materials for their sewing unit. When that first got going, they were actually they got a big supply of surplus burlap from the government and unwound the burlap to use the actual individual threads from that for sewing. Local companies that had excess materials would donate them. Even the bookbinding unit, they would make collections of magazine articles and bind them for local institutions. That was stuff that was just, basically taken right out of the garbage.
Yeah. The Milwaukee Handicrafts Project was actually one of the few integrated programs in the WPA. How did that come to be?
The WPA itself was, it was supposed to be, the Roosevelt administration insisted that there be no discrimination in it. But a lot of that, the actual implementation of that was left to local administrators. And the thinking among people in that position at the time generally, which, we can see today that this is pretty nakedly racist, but their thinking was that African Americans had a lower standard of living and were therefore, less in need of this kind of relief. So that led to obviously a lot of discrimination within trying to dole these jobs out. But again, Elsa Ulbricht who was at the head of this, she rejected that idea. There were a few hundred African American women who were assigned to the project, but they were assigned to an alternative work site aside from the main one. And when she found out about that, she wanted everybody to work in the same place. She didn't want this to be segregated in any way. And that was, it was really through her will that allowed that to happen. And again, that was a fairly integrated WPA projects were pretty rare.
Hmm. So the project itself starts to break apart around the start of World War II. And you see this shop go down and down and down until the project eventually ends. That being said, what do we see as the legacy of the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project today?
Well, I think the legacy, the most visible legacy, I guess you could say today, is the things that they made. The photography in the piece, those were all items that came from the UWM Archives Department. They have the Ulbricht papers there. And a lot of the artwork that survives is there. So it's in these institutions. The doll making unit that they had, those are still around today. Those are among doll collectors very prized. The furniture they made was still in use, possibly today, still at least as of very recently. It's kind of hard to go around and check up on these things right now, but I know at the public library downtown, they still had furniture that they made. The high school in Shorewood, I believe, also had some furniture that they made. But I'd say that the real legacy of this was in the 5,000 plus women who found work there, who were able to make a better living for their household. A lot of the women who worked on the project ended up finding better jobs. I don't know if I call it a complaint, but one of the issues that the administrators had in running this was that they had such high turnover among their workforce because other WPA projects, they found out that, the women who came from the Handicrafts Project really knew what they were doing. They were very skilled. So a lot of them got better paying jobs elsewhere within these New Deal jobs. A lot of them got jobs in the private sector. So I think that is, it's a little harder to measure than what you'll find in the archives or in furniture in a library today. But, that's 5,000 people who were able to better themselves through this project.
Matthew Prigge is a writer whose article on the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project was featured in Milwaukee Magazine. We spoke in November of last year. You can find a link to Prigge's article with more on the Milwaukee Handicrafts Project at WUWM.com. History can sometimes seem like a dry topic, a world made up of men in white wigs and pressed coats, making important and often dispassionate decisions. In reality, there have always been scandals that have shaped our collective history, including here in Wisconsin. Author Anna Lardinoy writes about many of these defining moments in her book, Storied and Scandalous Wisconsin, a history of mischief and menace, hero and heartbreak. She joins me to talk about it. Anna, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me. I am delighted to share with you some more wild tales about Wisconsin.
What was it like for you doing this research?
Well, it was a whole lot of fun. It was absolutely fascinating because not only was I digging through some of our more scandalous history, but I was also able to kind of put into context how we got to where we are now. So I found it really fascinating that Wisconsin was imagined as a dry state, which I find incredibly ironic because today we are one of the most hard drinking states in the nation. So when I was looking at prohibition and immigration and how that all happened, I can see how the pendulum swung to where we are now. And when you look at these scandalous stories, you can see a lot of that and how we get to the places that we are today.
It was interesting. Of course, the book mentioned the county where I grew up, Walworth County, was a dry county. And of course, now it is not. What were some of those surprising stories that you came across as you were doing this book?
Well, I think that the story that found me was the story of the police chief who was caught in a love triangle that resulted in the murder of his lover. I came across it when I was actually investigating a mob hit from the same era that's in the book, because there's a section on organized crime in Wisconsin. And this case was breaking around the same time. And how I do a lot of my research is just by reading old newspapers. So I continued to see headlines for these stories, and they just drew me in. And then when I discovered this love triangle and that this police chief's wife killed his lover with his own revolver, and it just got so sordid, it was a story that wanted me to tell it. And so I think that that was one of the more surprising ones. And it's not all morbid. There are some slightly sweet stories, but scandal usually goes along with tragedy.
It does. I mean, one of the stories that really stuck out to me, I think there are going to be few Milwaukeeans who don't know about runaway slave Joshua Glover and his release. The city takes a lot of pride in this story, but one of the people most closely associated with it, at least at the time, was Sherman Booth, who had a major scandal.
It is a horrible story, and it's hard to believe that anything is named in his honor after that, to be perfectly frank. It was one of the most scandalous things that happened in its day. And when you read the transcripts of that trial, and for people who don't know what we're talking about, Sherman Booth is later accused of raping a 14-year-old babysitter. And she is such an innocent that she does not even realize what's happening to her. She just knows that it's a bad thing. And Sherman Booth basically admits that he did this to her father and offers him money to keep it quiet. But the father, even during this era, is livid. And Sherman Booth says, if you publicize this, it's going to be bad for your daughter. And Carolyn Cook's father does not care. He wants to see justice served. And Sherman Booth is right. They make this girl seem terrible. She's accused of wearing short sleeve dresses to school. It's scandalous. And when you are reading through the transcripts, one thing that really struck me is at a time when there is really no sex education, the newspapers are having complicated conversations about things like hymens. So I have to imagine that this scandal also educated the city on a lot of different aspects of sex. At the end of the day, he is never punished for this in the courts, but his wife leaves him. You know, he is persona non grata, and he ends up having to go to Illinois and start his life over again. So he's definitely a scandalous figure. And I actually tell this story sometimes on one of my tours, because we're in Yankee Hill, where a lot of his things happened. But I tell people this in order to kind of make them feel better about our current political situations, just to point out that things have always been kind of terrible. We've been able to overcome it, and we'll be able to overcome this as well.
It must be interesting reading through those newspapers from that time and seeing the story kind of go back and forth, because, you know, as you mentioned, Sherman Booth said that this would be very difficult for this young woman. It was very difficult for her, but, you know, things kind of swung both ways. What is it like having that outside perspective, looking at, people really dealing with this situation as it's happening?
Well, it's really fascinating, because not only are you looking at it to watch how it plays out, but I can't get away from the fact that I am looking at it through my modern framework. And so my ideas about the things that are happening are often different, and especially because I am a woman. And a lot of these stories involve women being victimized and women doing violent things to try to take back power in their own lives. And so I look at that from a definite different perspective than it played out in the 1800s. And it's really hard for me to separate those two things. And I think that that plays out a lot in the tone of my pieces, even when I try not to do that, just because it's being filtered through who I am.
You have to come at it with your whole self. You know, you can't, of course, divorce your personhood from your writing. That would be, in some ways, disingenuous.
Well, it's somewhat interesting to me because I was working with a female editor on this. And even though we are both modern women living in this contemporary time, we did look at things differently. And she really took me to task a few times on the way that I presented the tale of the woman who was shot down in Madison in front of a grocery store. I told the story through the framework of that this man was a manipulative murderer. And she said I was being far too harsh on him, that the woman who was killed was leading him on.
Yeah. Now, there were a lot of things that happened here in Milwaukee. There was one event that you mentioned right at the top, a famous event that I'd heard of before, of course, but I hadn't known it was in Milwaukee until I moved here, the attempted assassination of Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt, and this story, is running as a third-party candidate. And he is touring the country in order to support the Bull Moose Party and his own presidency. And this is another story where that social fabric falls apart, because at the center of the story is a very mentally ill man who has had dreams that he has been told to kill Roosevelt to prevent him from starting this third party and ruining the country. And he's been following Roosevelt around the country, but Roosevelt just didn't realize it. So they finally meet up here in Milwaukee, and Roosevelt is standing outside waving to a throng of fans, and he is shot in the chest by this man. Well, there are some great historic photos of people diving towards the shooter in the crowd, and they managed to secure him. Roosevelt does get wounded by the bullet. He gives his speech anyway, which he does not condense in any way. He's speaking for nearly an hour. He's bleeding through the entire time. And part of the fun part of retelling this story is that the thing that really prevents him from dying is that he has his speech folded up in his breast pocket. And it's so thick that, plus his glasses case, kind of absorb some of this impact from the bullet and help it not to penetrate quite as deeply. But to Roosevelt's dying day, he lived with that bullet in his chest, lodged in a rib. The man who shot him eventually spends the remainder of his days in a psychiatric institution. But now this becomes part of fun Milwaukee lore, and you can actually see the marker where this happened if you go to the downtown Hyatt.
Hmm. So to take a kind of interesting turn, we so often have you on to talk about the supernatural. And it's, I guess, no surprise that your book includes just a touch of that. And there was a man that became famous for his psychic ability. Tell us a bit about this man, Arthur Price Roberts.
Roberts, yes. He is one of my favorite characters in Milwaukee. He is, for a time, one of Milwaukee's most famous citizens, and he's definitely one of the most well-known psychics in the country. Some people even called him the American Sherlock Holmes, because like that character, he would meet people and reveal something unnerving about them. But rather than observation, he claimed that it came from his psychic powers. And he's definitely famous throughout the arc of his life. He is hired by a bank to find out who robbed one of their banks, and he decides to have a seance. And that seance results in a name, and that person is arrested and goes to trial. He is able to find dead bodies just by using the power of his mind. But how he really launches himself into the history of Milwaukee is when he correctly predicts that there's going to be a series of bombings in Milwaukee in 1935. Now, some people know this story, that we had a number of bombings. The Shorewood Village Hall is dynamited, two First National Banks, later on a police substation gets dynamited, and all of this is foretold by Doc Roberts. And he even predicts the way it's all going to end. It is all entirely correct. But if we're looking at it through a modern framework, you can definitely see it's also very vague. But that particular case actually is still used to this day in some circles as evidence that psychic phenomena exists. So fascinating character. And I think one of the most interesting things about him is that his last official prediction was probably his most important. He correctly predicted his own death due to natural causes. Just a little fun fact.
Yeah. It's interesting looking back at these kinds of stories. And for you, who have spent so much of your career digging into the kind of bizarre past of our community especially, what do you think is the benefit of retelling and learning about them?
Well, I think it's multifold. I think just on a basic level, it's extremely entertaining. And I think that it helps us draw parallels between the past and the present, because we see that people are really never altogether that different. So especially in times that we live in now, where people feel like this is the end. No, we've always been like this. These things have always happened. It is part of the human experience. So I think in that sense, it's both entertaining and comforting. But I also think when we look at the events that happened in the past, we better understand the world in which we live in today, because we see the things that happen to create the laws that we live with, to create the social structure that we have agreed to live by. And so I know that seems like a more serious look at some really entertaining stories, but I think if you're really looking at this type of work as a collection, that's definitely what you get out of it. How do we get to where we are today is always found in the past.
Anna Lardnoy is a local historian, tour guide, and the author of Storied and Scandalous Wisconsin. We spoke in November of last year. He has his own statue to memorialize the fame and glory he brought to Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin. And no, we're not talking about the Bronze Fonz. We're talking about the Crusher. We'll have more on the pro wrestler's career in about 12 minutes. But first, we'll tell you all about the writing competition that inspired a children's book about COVID-19. That's coming up on Lake Effect here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Our Bodies Stay Home, Our Imagination Runs Free is a children's book by Milwaukee author Laura Heiler. It follows 7-year-old Maya as she navigates life during the coronavirus pandemic. The book is intended to help children understand how they can cope and find joy in this new normal. Heiler wrote the book in just 10 days after learning about a contest for authors. She spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last July about why she chose to pursue this challenge.
Like everyone else, really struggling with the changes to my life caused by coronavirus. And then, of course, as a children's book author, started thinking about how children must be impacted by this when suddenly they didn't have, you know, classroom setting, they didn't have play dates, they didn't have time with their extended family members. So I became aware of a challenge created by the Emory Global Health Institute out of Atlanta, and they were encouraging authors to write a book that would help children cope, and there was a 2-week period for us to write our books.
And what did you initially think of that challenge? Was it a welcome challenge or somewhat intimidating?
Well, I have a traditional publisher and I have a 3-book contract for a middle grade series. The first book debuted in March of 2018 called The Stupendous Adventures of Mighty Marty Hayes. I was in the middle of writing book 2 when I became aware of the Emory Global Health Institute challenge and basically said, wow, I don't have time to do this. And then I was there were about 10 days remaining in the challenge when I decided to jump in. So I contacted my publisher. I contacted my illustrator who is based in Barbados, and we all decided to go for it. So the challenge was undertaken.
So tell us why you wanted to center this story around Maya and her family. Did this character and her world come pretty quickly and naturally to you?
It came pretty quickly. I was definitely paying attention to the changes in my neighborhood. I live in a beautiful wooded subdivision in Glendale, Wisconsin, and was listening to how the children around me were coping. So lots of different ages, and I could still hear lots of laughter. And then I would have chats with some of the older kids, middle school, high school, and they were really talking about some of the challenges with the online studying and not seeing an end in sight. They didn't know when they would get back into the classroom. So I decided to create a story of fiction, but still adhering to the safety measures that we were all following, are still all following. And I came up with 7-year-old Maya, her 10-year-old brother Brian. The parents are working from home, and then they're separated physically from the grandparents, but they are very much still part of their lives, and they're dealing with them, talking to them via video chat. So I was hoping to create a realistic situation about what a family may be dealing with, but yet really trying to have fun with it as well.
Just as you mentioned, those images of living at home constantly surrounded by your family of all ages, virtual learning and the struggles that come with that, to Maya still trying to have a meaningful birthday party coming up. Do you think these key images will be ingrained in our brains when people look back and ask, what was the coronavirus like?
Yeah, one thing that jumped out at me as I walked around my own neighborhood, as I talked to children, was, you know, and many of us have seen this, you take walks and you see the chalk art, and people are putting together very uplifting messages. So I sort of did a take on that, played with that a little bit, and came up with a unique take on it. But it was really much thinking in terms of the kind of advice that we would have gotten from Mr. Rogers at this time, and that would have been to look to the helpers. And in my mind, I was thinking the children are very much our helpers as we go through the pandemic, because they are still having a sense of play, a lot of ingenuity as far as how they're approaching it. And I really took a lot of comfort from, you know, hearing the children's laughter in my neighborhood, seeing them keeping their day going and still just kind of getting through it. And then, of course, with the warmer weather, they are getting even more creative in their play while still social distancing. And it's just a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah. And what message did you want to convey to young children dealing with the ups and downs of suddenly living a different lifestyle as we are adjusting to the pandemic?
What I think has been fearful for children has the sense that it's out of their control, right? So they hear about the pandemic, they see the impact that it has on their family. If their family is, you know, struggling to just maintain some sort of schedule when mom and dad are working from home, or one parent is working from home, and then the parents also need to assist with online schooling, the kids are hearing the stress in their parents' voices, they're sensing the frustration, and they're feeling like there's nothing they can do. But when they are taught the proper safety measures and they're taught that they are helping to eradicate the virus, that gives them a real sense of empowerment. And it also leads to them seeing an end in sight, knowing that a vaccine is coming, knowing that school will resume one day in person again, and really starting to flourish, I think, with some of the online opportunities that have been out there. I've shared resources on my website to really let kids know that there's a lot that they can do. They can still visit places around the world like zoos and listen to authors reading their books and do a lot of things that otherwise they probably would not have thought of getting fully engaged in when they were on their regular schedule. So the key has been to you know, really equip the kids with information so that they can flourish during this time.
You wanted to reach kids that are about anywhere from 6 to 10 years old with this book. And you were kind of touching upon kids' special outlook during this period. So, and to me, it kind of shows a resiliency, you know. So are we also highlighting the resiliency that kids can hold and that you could express through the character Maya?
Oh, very much so. I think you know, we really have to listen to kids during this time, and we may be surprised what we hear, because the kids are really asking questions based on their age level, really figuring out what they can do. And then once they feel like their questions have been answered, they're ready to go. So one of the activities that I have going on in the book is I have Maya listening to what she and her brother need to do around the house. So they need to help with disinfecting, for example. And then she comes up with an idea that the family can make masks for the community and for the neighborhood. And it really gives kids a sense of, you know, we're all in this together and we can all make this situation better if we all pitch in. And so we very much have that going on. And you can imagine a seven-year-old, how she's viewing this. And but like I said, there's a lot of fun and laughter. She and her brother have a good time spending time together. They're on the various video chats with friends and family and coming up with creative things like, let's eat ice cream while we're talking to our grandparents. And then she is turning eight. So there's a bit of a surprise at the end of the book as to how the family decides to handle her birthday party. And so, you know, we're really just talking about, yes, kids are very resilient, and it's a matter of letting them really make some choices about how they're going to go through their day.
And not only make some choices, but acknowledging that it's okay to feel the ups and downs of this too.
Very much so. Yeah. I do deal with one or two meltdowns in the book. So a seven-year-old is going to have that. Sometimes a 10-year-old would have a meltdown as well, but it comes from a sense of frustration and they're feeling uncomfortable. And that's where that usually comes from. So again, there's a lot of reassurance that comes from both parents and her older brother. And I think that this book will be very relatable for kids who have felt some of the fear associated with the coronavirus, but also seeing just tons of signs of hope throughout the book.
On that note of families, not just here in the greater Milwaukee area, but around the world, sitting down and sharing this story together, how do you hope your book will play a part in helping kids in the future understand this moment in history, but also kids and parents get together and know how each other's feeling or to work through this together?
Yeah, I think that I'm hearing comments from adults, certainly, about how they've had time for reflection and how they were able to find some real upsides associated with spending a lot more time around their immediate family. And so I think kids are probably experiencing that as well. So I think we're seeing that probably the stress level of the family has reduced over time, and the kids are seeing that there were some really positive outcomes. So yeah, I think they will walk away after reading this book feeling very uplifted and really taking some positive measures into their future lives as they experience the new normal.
Laura Heiler is an author from Milwaukee. She spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last July about her children's book, Our Bodies Stay Home, Our Imagination Runs Free. There's a statue in South Milwaukee that memorializes pro wrestling legend Da Crusher. Coming up, we'll look back at his career and the early days of pro wrestling. That's next on Lake Effect, here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. You may know the beer that made Milwaukee famous, but how about the man? Reggie Da Crusher Lisowski was a pro wrestler from South Milwaukee, whose career spanned from the 1950s through the 80s. His tagline, "The Man Who Made Milwaukee Famous," was a nod to his character, which was pure Milwaukee. Da Crusher was a blue-collar, beer-drinking man who ate Polish sausages and came on stage to polka music. This persona is part of what endeared him to Chris Smith, a South Milwaukee native and the organizer that helped build a statue in honor of Da Crusher. Smith and I spoke about Da Crusher's career and the early days of pro wrestling in 2019, while the statue was being constructed.
The thing about Da Crusher was he reached his height of popularity and peaked, just like all people do, wrestlers, celebrities, whatever. And he was winding down at the end of his career, just as wrestling kind of got into the mainstream in the 80s with Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant and all those guys. And Crusher, you know, wrestled a little bit for the WWF right at the end of his career, part-time. But if the nationalization of wrestling would have occurred earlier, or if the Crusher somehow could have prolonged his career, you know, he was like Hulk Hogan before Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan actually learned from him. They came up in the same company, which was called the AWA, and it was based out of Minneapolis. And so they wrestled all over the place. Crusher wrestled all over the planet, but primarily it was a Midwest territory. And so that's why he's still very popular among the baby boomer generation, especially Milwaukee, because no matter where he wrestled, he was announced, you know, the man that made Milwaukee famous. And so he reached a pretty significant, at least in the Midwest and especially in Wisconsin, I mean, you could definitely consider him a celebrity at the time.
So he was the PBR of wrestlers.
Absolutely. I mean, he's very, just very Milwaukee.
As someone who is not so familiar with, you know, the history of WWE, the history of wrestling, professional wrestling more generally in the U.S., what was it like in the 1960s, 1970s, compared to what we might think of more in the 80s and even now?
It's an interesting history. I mean, you go back to the 50s and wrestling was covered like any sport is now in the newspapers, and people followed it like it was a legitimate sporting competition. Now we know, and most suspected, or maybe in the 50s, not most, but some suspected, that it was scripted, okay? And it still is. But, you know, wrestlers to this day do not appreciate anyone, you know, claiming that it's fake, because the pain is real, and these are, and Crusher was a terrific athlete. His tag team partner, Dick the Bruiser, played for the Packers. So, I mean, they're real athletes. It's absolutely real, but, you know, the endings are and probably always were scripted. So back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, this was what they call the territorial days. And you had Vince McMahon Sr. in the Northeast, based in New York City. And you had someone called Vern Gagne, who was based out of Minneapolis, and he ran the AWA. And then you had the Mid-South, and you had the Houston wrestling. You had a bunch of territories, and they were very territorial, and they respected each other's territories. And the AWA, which covered the Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, was very successful. A lot of the wrestlers that the younger generations have heard about, it wouldn't be unusual for them to come through the AWA, like Hulk Hogan, Big John Studd, Bobby the Brain Heenan, Mean Gene Okerlund. They all came through the AWA. And so what ended up happening in the 80s, Vince McMahon Sr., who ran what was first called the WWWF, but then they shortened it to just the WWF, he sold the company to his son, Vince McMahon Jr., and Vince McMahon Jr. did something that no one ever did and that really the other promoters didn't like. He basically bought airtime in every territory. Just long story short, nationalized wrestling. And it was a success. The other territories fought him, but he was making enough money that he could lure the big stars like Hulk Hogan from the AWA. And then it just, in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, it got extremely popular. They teamed up with MTV, did something called Rock and Wrestling. And at the time, very popular celebrities got involved, like Mr. T and Cyndi Lauper. And so it just kind of took off and the territories kind of died. And so Crusher was absolutely one of the most popular wrestlers in the territories. And unfortunately, when Vince McMahon Jr. kind of took over, he did bring Crusher on, but it was in a very part-time basis because he was just older and he just was at the end of his career at that point. So I also work kind of for the city of South Milwaukee, where Crusher was from, and so decided something needed to be done about this because someone who was so popular and so successful, but also on the other side of the coin, away from wrestling, by all accounts, just a very good and generous human being, I figured, like, you know, if we don't do something, my kids aren't going to know who he is. And my kids' kids certainly won't know who he is. So hopefully we'll maintain his memory.
Yeah. To just go back a little bit to, you know, the kinds of personas that you get with wrestling. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, in the 1950s, it was regarded as this kind of, you know, very real sport. Mm-hmm. But there is that scripted element of it now and in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the personas are a big part of that and a big part of what really made the Crusher mm-hmm. who he was. Can you give us some, you know, he was the Milwaukee guy. Can you give us some examples of how that manifested in his character?
Absolutely. I mean, your character, you know, and wrestlers now call it your gimmick, okay? Mm-hmm. You have to have something that gets the crowd interested in you. You know, wrestler's worst nightmare is you're out there, you're getting announced, and the crowd does nothing. They want you either booing or they want you cheering, okay? Either one is good. You know, so over the decades, wrestlers come up with a character. Andre the Giant was the big, mean, nasty giant. You know, before that, he was a good guy, too. But, you know, you had cowboys. You had a guy from Canada who called himself Rowdy Roddy Piper, who wore a kilt and acted like he was from Scotland. And you had people in masks, and you had people who were like, you know, voodoo priests. You had Native American characters, you know. So Crusher's character, if you will, I don't know how much different it was from who he was as a person, because he would come out to polka music. He would call himself the man that made Milwaukee famous. He would do interviews and talk about, you know, back in Milwaukee, he won the crown of Mr. Saloon 10 years in a row, and that's because he could eat the most Polish sausage and drink the most beer and throw the drunks out of the saloon and do the polka. And very famously, he would say his workout consisted of running along the shores of Lake Michigan with a keg of beer on his shoulder. And when his workout was over, the keg was empty. You know, so that was his character, and it was probably very much inspired by who he really was, because he grew up in South Milwaukee, went to South Milwaukee High School. He raised a family there, and I work in that town. I work for the city, and if I had a dollar for every Crusher story I've heard from people there, I'd have a lot more money than I do now.
You know, you mentioned the beer barrel running mm-hmm. around with the beer barrel, and he himself was a very barrel-chested yeah. kind of guy, not exactly who you would look at and say, oh, that man's a wrestler.
Yeah, he didn't have the physique of like a bodybuilder like some wrestlers do, especially in the 80s, a lot of them did. But he was built, and he was thick, and he was strong. And in this process here of creating this statue, I've worked closely with the Crusher's daughters, which has been very much a joy for me. And Crusher measured all his measurements, his biceps, his chest, and they kept that. And so the statue is actually going to mirror that. And he was a big, stout guy. Now, his physique changed as he got older a little bit, but he was always a big, strong man.
For someone who was able to have a very long career, considering what his career was, you have to imagine he was very fit.
Right. And before he could wrestle full time, and before he started wrestling, he, you know, was a blue-collar worker. He was a bricklayer. He had a bunch of jobs that were all very physical, and then he became successful enough wrestling that he could do that full time.
So you mentioned you've been working with his daughters mm-hmm. to get this statue built. You know, what is that process like, actually getting, I mean, first of all, getting the place to put the statue, getting, I'm assuming there's permits involved with that, mm-hmm. and then getting really the momentum in the community to get this thing built and building it.
Well, you know, going back to raising the money, I mean, I talked to a number of different places that could create the statue, and pretty much my target was $40,000. And honestly, I anticipated this being something that would kind of just mirror my career. I'm 40. I just turned 40. And I thought, over the next 20, 25 years, you know, I'll try to do this. And then hopefully by the time I retire, I'll have enough money that I can kick in whatever we need and then get this thing done. And, you know, it just goes to show that still, you know, I mean, we're 14 years after his death. He died in 2005. How much people still love him. I launched the website in very late December, after Christmas, 2017, and we were fully funded by March. So 3 months, basically. And we actually got more donations than we even thought we needed. And so then the process of actually creating the statue, we picked a very reputable firm in Milwaukee called Vanguard Sculpture Services. The owner actually went to South Milwaukee High School, knew the Crusher's daughter, so it was kind of very cool. And I've had a lot of people in the city come up to me and say, oh, you're so popular for doing this. Because it's a very, I mean, in 2019, 2018, pretty much it doesn't seem like people can agree on anything. But social media, you got to really search for a negative comment about the Crusher statue, okay? We're not asking for public money. It was all privately funded. And pretty much the response has been super positive. And so I've had people come up to me and say, whoa, you're very popular in South Milwaukee right now because you're behind this. And I would always reply to them, yeah, but if the statue turns out and looks like crap, my name will be mud. But very recently we have seen, and the Crusher's daughters and myself have seen, the final clay sculpture, and we gave it the green light to go forward to make the mold, to get, you know, whatever this process is, to have it made out of bronze. And I am no longer worried about my name being mud over this, at least, because it looks wonderful.
Chris Smith organized and fundraised for De Crusher statue. We spoke in 2019. If you haven't yet seen the statue, you can see pictures of it on our website, wuwm.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of our conversations this week on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, you can look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Join us again tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.